Take your copy of God's Word and open to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. We'll begin reading in verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back. The beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things." We'll stop there for today. Well, the easiest part of Daniel is behind us. We've made it to the second half of the book, which is quite a bit more difficult. In fact, today we begin looking at the prophetic section of the book of Daniel. Chapters 1 through 6 are predominantly narrative, historical narrative, with a few predictive prophecies sort of scattered through it. But the last half of the book of Daniel, chapters 7 through 12, are primarily predictive prophecy with a little bit of narrative. It's just the opposite, sort of flip-flop. One might argue that the first 6 chapters of this book establish not only Daniel's background, but his credentials as a prophet of God. In other words, the first 6 chapters validate, so to speak, the prophecies of the last half of the book. Now, in chapters 7 through 12, the last half of the book, we're actually going to study 4 visions. Given to us all in chronological sequence. Chapter 7 here is given to us, according to verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar. Chapter 8, which is that vision of the ram and the male goat, or if you were brought up on the King James, you probably mentioned the ram and the he-goat. It is actually given in the 3rd year of Belshazzar, same king, but 2 years later. That means that these first 2 visions in chapters 7 and 8 actually occurred prior to Belshazzar's feast back in chapter 5. So the chronological order of Daniel is messed up as far as you look at the book as a whole, because it's not written in chronological order. It's not arranged that way. It's more thematic. The first half being narrative, historical narrative, the second half being prophetic. Now, the vision of chapter 9, containing what is often referred to as the 70 weeks of Daniel, actually occur in the first year of Darius, which means that chronologically, that chapter probably contains a vision that Daniel received before the episode of the lion's den that we studied in the last chapter. Now, the final vision in the book, chapters 10 through 12, occur in the third year of Cyrus, making that last section the latest dated material in the book of Daniel. So as you can see, as I've said, if you just take them as separate entities, two books almost, they're both in chronological order. 1 through 6 is in chronological order. 7 through 12 is in chronological order. But when you take them as an entire book, 1 through 12, the chronology does flow differently. And God had a purpose in that, no question. So chronologically, we're traveling back in time today in this chapter. We're traveling back before Daniel was thrown in the lion's den. We're traveling back before Belshazzar had that feast and there was the handwriting on the wall. Stephen Miller writes of this chapter, quote, "Modern commentators are generally agreed that chapter 7 is the single most important chapter in the book of Daniel," end quote. N.W. Porteous describes it as the heart of the book of Daniel. E.W. Heaton writes, quote, "It would be no exaggeration to say that this chapter is one of the most important passages in the Old Testament," end quote. It's quite a progression there in those quotes. In his commentary on this book, John Walvoord writes, quote, "As interpreted by conservative scholars, the vision of Daniel provides the most comprehensive, detailed prophecy of future events to be found anywhere in the Old Testament," end quote. And he is specifically speaking about Daniel chapter 7 there in that part of his commentary. I can offer you a ton more quotes by other commentators that say much the same thing, but you get the gist. Now, I'm going to split this chapter into three separate studies. Today, Lord willing, we're going to cover verses 1 through 8. Next week, we will cover verses 9 through 14. And then we'll cover basically the second half of the chapter the third week as we get into this. Let me say up front, though, it is going to be very difficult in looking at these first 8 verses without mentioning something of what's coming in this chapter. My good friend and brother Jason Schultz is actually preaching through the book of Daniel as well at this time, and he preached this entire chapter in one sitting. It was a lengthy sermon, but he preached it all in one sitting, and there is some wisdom behind that. I guess I'm not the wiser of the two, but I just didn't see any way that I could get everything that I wanted to say into one sermon, so we're going to try to do it in three sermons. But again, not without a glance forward. In the chapter, we will mention a number of things. My goal in these 3 weeks is that we understand Daniel chapter 7. And if that means we occasionally glance forward to something that's said later in the chapter, so be it. I'm not worried about necessarily doing things a certain way, but doing things in a way that you can better understand this chapter once we've completed it. Well, the name of this sermon is simply A Beastly Vision. A beastly vision. And we're going to see 4 major empires, 4 major kingdoms described to Daniel, along with an extension of the last one. We won't deal with that very much today because it's explained more in the interpretation of this vision later on in this chapter. This prophetically occurs to what, describes what Jesus calls the times of the Gentiles. That's effectively what all of this is about. So it begins in verse 1 by saying in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and the visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Now in the last chapter, in chapter 6, the episode of Daniel and the lion's den, We were already a couple of years at least into the reign of Darius the Mede in the Medo-Persian Empire. In that chapter, Babylon was in the rearview mirror. They had fallen, and another nation had conquered them by that time. Obviously, as I said earlier, this text backs us up even to the first year of that final king, Belshazzar, or at least the final king that Daniel mentions. I actually told you a number of weeks ago that Nabonidus was officially the final king of Babylon. In fact, if you check history books, Nabonidus is the one that will be named as the final king. However, he was absent from the capital for long periods of time. He'd be gone for years sometimes from the capital city. And so, about 3 years into his reign in 553 B.C., he named his son Belshazzar, this one, as co-regent, or as Belshazzar would have called it, the second ruler in the kingdom of Babylon. That's why he offered the wise men, if they could interpret the handwriting on the wall, the place of the third ruler. So Nabonidus was the first ruler, Belshazzar was the second ruler, and whoever could interpret the handwriting on the wall could have been the third ruler. But to the citizens of the capital city, who never saw Nabonidus and saw Belshazzar regularly ruling this empire, they would have considered Belshazzar the actual king. And so that's why Daniel mentions him exclusively here in this study. Now, in 553 B.C., Daniel would have been in his upper 60s. Most likely. Well, when we caught him in the last chapter, he was into his 80s by that point. But here, he's just in his upper 60s, and he has, to some degree, retired from public service. He's not what he was under Nebuchadnezzar. You know, Belshazzar had to call him basically out of retirement to interpret the handwriting on the wall. And I'm certain that Daniel is still involved some, but not enough that Belshazzar knows who he is. Nebuchadnezzar, by the way, had died around 10 years ago at this point. He'd been dead about 10 years. And in just a decade, the throne of Babylon had become quite insecure. But Nabonidus had restored some of that security of the throne, especially as he placed his son Belshazzar there. Now, Belshazzar was a wicked man. If you were here during the study of the handwriting on the wall, you know that. This is the man that brought out the temple vessels and basically drank wine by the bowlful out of them. You know, he was a wicked man. He didn't care anything about the Lord and morality. And so the Jews, understandably, would have been extremely concerned about the reign of this man. And it seems that in response to that, God gives Daniel this vision here in this chapter that they actually would have security and that they would even play a role in the end times. But I can't cover all of that today. That's later in the chapter. But these first eight verses record essentially the first part of this dream that is mentioned here. The interpretation is given as we move through the chapter, an interpretation that we will not cover today, though we will mention some things out of it. Chapter 7 is the recording of that dream, and it says here specifically that Daniel gave the sum of the matter. That is, Daniel gives the essence of the dream. In fact, that word sum could be translated essence. He gives the essence of the dream. He doesn't give all of the specifics, but he gives us plenty enough. In fact, he gives us enough that, as I said earlier, most commentators consider this to be the most important chapter in the book of Daniel and one of the most important chapters in all of the Old Testament, at least as it relates to biblical prophecy. Now, Whether liberal or conservative, most scholars agree that the dream we studied back in chapter 2 and this dream here essentially cover the same territory. We're given a few more specifics here in chapter 7. There's no question about that. But they essentially cover the same territory. And if you were here in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of this metallic man, as Milburn Cockrell calls it that I've been listening to him, I've been working through him, his study of the book of Daniel, and he continually calls him the metallic man. I know, it just strikes me sort of funny. He had his own way of talking. Those of you that ever heard him preach know that. But this metallic man, as he refers to it, he had a head of gold and a chest and arms of silver. His middle and his thighs were made of bronze. He had legs of iron, and he had feet that were partly iron and partly clay. And we went into some detail talking about those things. Now, back then, these kingdoms, if you will, were represented from man's point of view. In other words, to humans, great empires appear to be like precious metals. We might say, as Brian mentioned earlier in his sermon, that the United States is the greatest country that's ever been. Well, I would make the argument that Israel is the greatest country that's ever been, with far better laws than we've ever had. Nevertheless, the United States is a great country, and we've been given great freedoms. We might represent the United States from the point of view of being silver, and as it would relate to a precious metal or a diamond. That's how it's looked at in Daniel chapter 2. As you look at the kingdoms of man, they're looked at as these precious metals. But in chapter 7, a far different view of these kingdoms is given. In chapter 2, we have man's perspective. In chapter 7, we have God's perspective of these kingdoms. In the text before us today, they're not represented as precious metals. They're represented actually as these horribly beast-like kingdoms. Even beasts that aren't normal. Lions with eagle's wings. Bears that are lifted up on one side. A leopard that has bird's wings on its back. And another one that it can't even describe. It's so hideous. You see, from God's point of view, the kingdoms of man are rebellious against God. In fact, Psalm 2 makes that very, very clear. Now, you'll recall back in chapter 2, Daniel did not actually see the dream. Nebuchadnezzar dreamed the dream. But here, Daniel receives the vision through this dream himself, and then later an angel interprets it for him. It shouldn't strike us that there are similarities between the two dreams, the two prophecies, but yet completely different contrasts. One came to a pagan ruler, the other came to a prophet of God. You would expect that the vantage point through which you see these dreams are different, even though you're given the same information at the end of the day. And not to get ahead of ourselves, because I'm not going to cover it, but there is still a very familiar theme in this chapter. That theme is the kingdom of God. But we will not talk about that today. So Daniel, in this dream, verse 2 tells us that he saw the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. Now, one commentator in particular, and several commentators mentioned this, but one in particular went to great lengths to prove that this great sea is speaking about the Mediterranean. And maybe it is. I don't know. But there's no significance given to that here in this vision. It's not about the sea. If it's the Mediterranean, fine enough. But that's just not a major point here in this section. I think it's probably more likely that the sea is here used to describe sinful humanity. For instance, like in Isaiah chapter 57, verse 20, it says, the wicked are like the tossing sea, for it cannot be quiet, and its waters toss up mire and dirt. Or if you turn over to Revelation 17 and 18, and you've got that great harlot who is seated on many waters, we see the sinfulness of mankind described. I really believe it's pretty obvious that the sea is merely symbolic here, not necessarily talking about the Mediterranean, because if you'll look down in verse 17, it says, these four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. This time it says the earth. Before it says the sea, and now it says the earth. If it is the Mediterranean, why change? You know, it's just not a major point. It doesn't matter. Though, if it is the Mediterranean, then I guess the stress would be that the vision affects this part of the world, the Middle East. Though I think that's clear anyway. I don't think you need that to believe that. This is about the part of the world that we are studying about here. And that's going to become rather clear as we work through this. And notice, this great sea is stirred up by the four winds of heaven. The four winds, just speaking about the directional indicators, north, south, east, and west. But it seems apparent, at least to me, that this wind represents God's providence. Yes, these kings are coming up, but it is God's providence that is driving the governments of the world. That may come as a shock to you, but that has already been very clear in Daniel. Like in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel declared that he, God, changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. That is the work of the God of heaven. Relating this truth was the purpose behind Nebuchadnezzar's humbling back in chapter 4. You remember? He was to be humbled until he knew that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom He will. God is running the show. We ought to be reminded of that even this week as we inaugurated another president here in the United States of America, that it is God who raises up kings. And He's raised up everyone that we've ever had. Now, verse 3 tells us that out of this great sea that is being blown on by these four winds of heaven, out of this great sea, Daniel saw four great beasts different from one another. And as I said earlier, verse 17 tells us very plainly that these four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. And specifically, as verse 23 makes crystal clear, the kings just represent the kingdoms themselves. Daniel will only inquire, though, about the fourth one. He's going to ask a very general question about the dream, but once he's given an extremely short answer, he's going to say, yeah, but what about the fourth one? What about that fourth beast? So, today we'll spend most of our time talking about the first three. And we'll deal with the fourth one when we get to the interpretation in a couple of weeks. So, as was the case back in chapter 2 in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, this vision is going to describe kingdoms located generally in the same part of the world, the Middle East and those surrounding regions. This vision is not about Great Britain. It's not about Russia. It's not about the United States. It's not about Europe. It's about the Middle East. And that Asia Minor, you know, part of the world over there. I grow really tired of people, you know, using the United States as a barometer for biblical prophecy. It's just not legitimate. We're not given anything about that in Scripture. The Middle East is the barometer for, you know, biblical prophecy. Maybe we think too highly of ourselves. I don't know. But anyway, this first beast was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Now, I doubt you've ever seen a beast like this before. But Daniel did in this vision that he dreamed. Now, even today, we consider the lion to be the king of the forest, or maybe even the king of beasts. And certainly an eagle is considered to be a king of the birds. Well, interestingly, if you back up to chapter 2, what was Babylon represented as there? The king of the metals, so to speak. You know, Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that Babylon was represented by the head of gold, the most precious of metals. I'm sure you can already see the parallel between these two visions. And Daniel told Belshazzar, when he was brought before him to interpret the handwriting on the wall, he said this, "The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he, God, gave him, Nebuchadnezzar, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him." You can see, Babylon had lion-like attributes. I mean, if you rounded the corner in the forest and there's a lion sitting there, you will freak out. And people were scared of the kingdom of Babylon, at least when Nebuchadnezzar came to the throne and he was this general of the army who was known to be a great conqueror. Interestingly, as archaeological excavations have unearthed Babylon, winged lions have been found among the ruins of the city. Apparently, that was some bit of a symbol for them back in that day. That means Daniel certainly would have made a connection back in his day as he saw this. But as he continued to watch in his dream, its wings, this lion with eagle's wings, its wings were plucked off and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. This seems to be a clear reference to the change that was wrought on Nebuchadnezzar back in chapter 4. This lion-like conqueror, Nebuchadnezzar, was humbled. He had his wings plucked off, and he was made to stand on 2 feet like a lion, and the mind of a man was given to him. He was humbled, and because of that, he became a king who actually cared for his people. That's what chapter 4 is all about. Now, chapter 4 is this letter that the emperor wrote to his entire empire, to every citizen, to describe his conversion to them, telling them that they needed to fear the God of heaven. And he even began that letter with the words, "Peace be multiplied to you." You can see how this fits with Nebuchadnezzar perfectly. Well, as Daniel continued to dream, verse 5 tells us that this second beast appeared. They didn't all appear at once. They appeared in succession, just as these kingdoms would. And the second beast was like a bear, it says. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told, "Arise, devour much flesh." Now let me remind you that this dream was given to Daniel over a decade before Babylon fell. The Medo-Persians here are alive and they're a kingdom and they're coming. But he describes this kingdom and the next in great specificity before they ever rose to power. We cannot deny that God is the one who gave him this vision, especially as we get to the next one. You'll see what I mean when we get there. Now, this second beast, this one that is like a bear, is still strong, but is certainly not as elegant as a lion. You know, Nebuchadnezzar had been told that another empire would arise after him, but not one nearly as grand as he is. And so a bear is not as grand as a lion. And it had one side that appeared to be lifted up above the other. One side that was stronger than the other side. Well, it just so happens that this next kingdom that comes into this part of the world is the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. It's this divided empire. But the Medes who came first weren't the stronger of the two sides of that empire. The Persians actually were way stronger than the Medes. We're actually told this in the next chapter. In the vision of the ram and the male goat, in that vision, in chapter 8, verse 3, Daniel sees a ram with two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. Well, the angel Gabriel is going to interpret that dream or that vision for Daniel. And he describes it saying, "As for the ram that you saw with two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia." We're not left with any doubt as to who that's speaking. They are actually spoken of by name. Well, there's little doubt then that this second beast here in chapter 7, this beast who looked like a bear, represents the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. Well, what about the three ribs in his mouth? I'm glad you asked. Most likely, being that they're in the mouth of the bear, they are the three major areas that he conquered. We know from history that he conquered Babylon, Egypt, and Lydia. Three major areas that he conquered there with great ease, I'd say. But he didn't stop conquering. The Medo-Persian Empire actually grew to be the largest, square by square miles, the largest empire to date at this time. And so, there is this instruction to arise, devour much flesh. But he didn't stop with those three major areas. He continued spreading his power as he went. So Daniel continued to dream, and another animal walks out. This one, our text here tells us, looked like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So we have here another powerful beast, but nothing close to a lion or a bear. However, a leopard, or some commentators suggest a panther, is fast and has an insatiable thirst for blood. Where a bear will eat a lot of vegetables, it'll eat meat, but it'll eat a lot of vegetables. Not a panther, not a leopard. There's an insatiable thirst for blood. And you add these four wings of a bird on its back, and the view that we are given is that this leopard is lightning fast. This, not to give the end of the book away, but this represents the kingdom of Greece, which was the next major empire in that part of the world. Now listen, Alexander the Great's father had not been born at this time, much less Alexander the Great. But listen to the description that he gives here of Greece. It is very specific and very true. This lightning-fast leopard represents the Grecian Empire. Alexander the Great, the first king of the Greek Empire, invaded Asia Minor in 334 B.C. and conquered the entire Medo-Persian Empire in 10 years. It's unheard of. Nothing like that has happened before this time. One decade, and he had conquered the entire Medo-Persian Empire, which I told you was the biggest empire to date at that time. According to legend, Alexander wept because there was nothing else left to conquer. He had this insatiable thirst for conquering. This insatiable thirst for blood, much like a leopard. Almost immediately, he died. 323 B.C. He was 32 years old. And there began to be these struggles in the empire. And his Four generals ultimately carved the empire into four parts. Thrace, Macedonia, Syria, and Egypt. It's probably what these four heads are about. In fact, this is going to be described again in the next chapter, in the next vision. Daniel is going to talk about the notable horn between the eyes of the male goat, and that it will be broken and pushed into four different ways. That will be those four empires that come up from Greece. This is very specific. Hundreds of years before this happens. Notice, by the way, dominion was given to it. Now, Alexander would have viewed himself as a conqueror, and from the human point of view, he certainly was that. But God gave him dominion. Dominion was given to him. The Greek Empire was raised up, like all of these empires, by God's providence to be used for His purpose. And by the way, we are still influenced by the world or the empire of Greece today. Greatly influenced. Then Daniel dreams about this fourth beast. And we're told here in our text that this fourth beast was terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. Now, unlike the previous three beasts, no known animal is associated here with this one. You know, at first you got a lion, you got eagle's wings, you got a bear, you got a leopard with bird's wings. This time, though, Daniel has never seen anything like this. This beast just has a different feel to it as you read it. Even compared to a lion or a bear or a leopard, this beast is terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. That's quite a statement. I think I would consider a lion to be terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong, and a bear, and even a leopard. But in comparison to those, this fourth beast is said to be those things. This animal was big and powerful. He looked terrible. And then to cap it off, he had these great iron teeth. You may recall that the legs of the metallic man back in chapter 2 were made of iron, and the feet were made partly of iron and partly of clay. And it says of this beast, whatever he is, that he broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It seems that this kingdom, when it comes, will stamp out everything about the previous kingdoms, obliterating them and replacing them with something terrifying, something far more evil. Now, I hate to get back into this. I got into it several weeks ago when I was in chapter 2, but you're just going to have to bear with me. Many scholars, not all scholars, but many scholars believe this fourth beast is best represented by the Roman Empire. Some of you probably will dogmatically die with that view, and that's okay. But to me, the Roman Empire just doesn't seem to fit. Now, there's little identity about the first three beasts. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. Why is there little doubt? They are named by name in this book. But this fourth one is never named in this book. So we don't need to just take for granted that it's Rome. Now, I should mention, not every commentator believes that it represents Rome. Some have the order a little bit differently and actually have this fourth one representing Greece. They have the Medo-Persians being the two middle beasts here. I don't think that's correct for a number of reasons. But let's talk for a minute why I think it probably is not Rome. First of all, and I think the most convincing reason is because Rome simply did not cover the same area. If you take a map of the Roman Empire and you take a map of Babylon, Greece, and Medo-Persia, and you compare them, you will find that they operated on opposite sides of the Mediterranean. the Roman Empire was primarily European. Now, it did make its way to the other side of the Mediterranean, but not very far. Where these other three were predominantly Middle Eastern on over into Asia, completely different part of the world. In fact, Rome left nearly two-thirds of the area controlled by the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks completely untouched. They never walked in those areas that they controlled. There was a short period under Trajan, the conqueror, the general, when they attempted to move east, but they were only there a few months because most historians believe he had a stroke, and so they had to retreat, and they never went back. But as far as conquering that area, they didn't. They never made it to Babylon. The Roman Empire never made it to Babylon. If you were with us in our study of Revelation, you know that Babylon is a major focus all the way through the end of this book right here, all the way through Revelation 18. Babylon is a major player. And yet the Roman Empire never made it there. G.H. Lang writes, quote, "Rome of old did not rule effectively beyond the Euphrates. She never really absorbed Mesopotamia, and the vast eastern lands were never touched." So they did not control the same area. That's a problem for me, at least. The second problem is this hideous beast in this chapter is seen to obliterate the kingdoms that come before it. It stamped what was left with its foot. It completely done away with those previous kingdoms. And yet, that's not at all what Rome was. Rome was not really a conquering empire in that way. On the contrary, Rome was actually a nation-building empire, much like the United States. We go in and obliterate some area like Iraq, and then we spend billions of dollars building it back. That's very similar to the way that Rome operated. They'd conquer a region, but they would allow that region to continue with its religion, with its language, with its culture. I mean, all you got to do is open up the New Testament. What do you see happening in Jerusalem, in Israel? They are living by their own culture, speaking their own language, and worshiping in the temple, which, by the way, was protected by Roman law. That's a lot different than what we have described here in this passage. You say, but the Romans destroyed the temple in AD 70. Well, give me time. When we get to chapter 9, we'll talk about that. But they only did so because the Jews would not stop rebelling. Did the Romans have a powerful army that would squash you if you continued to rebel? Yes, they did. But if they'd have lived in peace, they could have kept going for a while. Of course, that was not God's plan. That was their judgment for rejecting their Messiah. So Rome was known for building infrastructure and roads throughout their empire. You've heard that old phrase, all roads lead to Rome. That's because Rome built, they built roads all through their empire. And they enacted laws that encouraged peace. Most of you know that Rome actually existed during that time known as the Pax Romana from 27 BC to 180 AD. It is still viewed as the most peaceful time that has ever been. Now, I don't mean to say that every emperor was good. They weren't. Christians suffered, especially under Nero and Domitian. Nevertheless, Rome did not wipe out the areas that they conquered. They absorbed them. But this fourth beast, verse 7 says, broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. Lang again writes, quote, "Rome never trampled upon or dominated Babylonia or Persia and certainly never consolidated its power there." That's true historically. Back in chapter 2, the same kingdom was said to break and crush all these. That is, the kingdoms that went before it. It's, like I say, it's just simply not a good description of Rome. Rome absorbed those kingdoms, especially the kingdom of Greece. Rome embraced Greek culture, including not only her language, but her religion. The names were changed. Zeus was changed to Jupiter. Artemis to Diana, Aphrodite to Venus, and so on. But it was the same religion, just with different names for their gods. As I said when we were back in chapter 2, there is actually a kingdom that arose and conquered every one of these areas dominated by the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, and the Greeks. Furthermore, it was extremely successful at enforcing not only rule, but changing culture, religion, and even the language. And the Middle East today is still affected by that empire. Today. That kingdom ruled from 632 AD until 1923. 1300 years. Of course, I'm referring to the Islamic Caliphate, or what many books refer to as the Ottoman Empire. It came in and stomped all of the other empires with its foot and didn't leave anything left from them. Joel Richardson writes, quote, "Here are the facts. Within 4 years after Muhammad died, roughly a third of a million Christians were slaughtered. Over the next 10 years, another million were killed. After 600 years of the church expanding through the entire Mediterranean region and the Middle East, in one generation, the ancient heart of the church was crushed. All of the great ancient capitals and missionary sending cities of Christianity throughout the region came under Islamic domination. Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria, as well as Ephesus and the other six churches of Revelation were all reduced to struggling outposts of the Christian world. Within a quick 100 years, 50% of global Christianity had come under Islamic subjugation and rule," end quote. That sounds like this fourth beast. Not Rome. And we're going to find in the latter part of the chapter that this fourth kingdom exists when the Son of Man returns and establishes His kingdom. Now listen, it drives me bonkers for people to hold the newspaper in one hand and Bible in the other. That's not how we ought to read the newspaper. But, that said, the goal of Muslims in the Middle East right now is to get the caliphate going again. And it could happen about that quick. It's not going to be difficult. It's not going to be difficult. The middle part of verse 7 says, "It," this fourth kingdom, "was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." Now, much is said about this in the latter part of the chapter. The interpretation of this specifically is what Daniel asks about in the latter part of the chapter. I'm not going to get into all of this today, but when we get there, we'll refer back to it, perhaps. Nevertheless, this little horn is described with man-like characteristics. He had eyes like the eyes of a man, speaking of intelligence. He had a mouth speaking great things. We're going to find out the latter part that those are blasphemous things against the God of heaven. I think then we can be certain that these other horns are also humans. In fact, I know we can because verse 24 says that they are 10 kings and that this little horn is just another king. And though he clearly comes up smaller, that's why it's called a little horn, by the time this chapter is over, he will grow to be much larger than all 10 of these other kings. The smallness of this horn just speaks about his beginning, not his end. Not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but this king will be in power at Jesus' second coming. And this text stresses that, but we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. Now listen, I know we've left you hanging because you're just right in the middle of a dream here. We haven't even covered the whole dream. We've just covered this first part. But there are a number of things that I want you to see in this. This fourth kingdom is important, as Daniel is going to specifically ask about this, but it is not the primary focus of this chapter. You say, well, it seems to be the primary focus today. Well, that's because I haven't finished the chapter. This is the wisdom of Jason finishing it all in one sermon. That he tells you the whole thing up front. I just wanted to go into a little bit more depth. The focus of this chapter is the kingdom of God, not the fourth kingdom. So make sure that you don't think I've told you the whole story today, because I have not. And listen, only God can write history before it happens. Only God. This is why the skeptics hate the book of Daniel. But this is written hundreds of years before, for instance, Alexander was born. And yet, with great specificity, especially the next chapter, he explains exactly how Alexander the Great's empire would rise up and how it would fall. To the point that he explains that he would die young and that his four generals would take over. The skeptics would love to take that out of the book, but it's here, nevertheless. And while we're on the point of fulfilled prophecy, Jesus fulfilled over 300 prophecies when he walked on this planet. The possibility that one person can fulfill one prophecy is beyond mathematical possibility. 300 is not calculatable. And yet it happened. The only explanation is that Jesus is, in fact, who he declared himself to be. And listen, if there's anything clear here, God is sovereign. And he has a plan. And he is going to bring it about. Dominion was given to these beasts by God's allowance. And for the record, God's plan has not been thwarted when you vote and your man isn't elected. The opposite, actually. God's plan is still right on track. Don't ever get thrown off. If people on social media are going to lose their mind, you shouldn't be one of them. You ought to know better. And listen, though man's kingdoms, from man's point of view, are these precious metals in this metallic man, from God's vantage point, they are beastly. And every one of them will have a coming day of reckoning one day. God is righteous, and he demands righteousness. And though we're not there yet in this chapter, Jesus is the King of God's kingdom, and we are all accountable to Him. And yet, the King of the kingdom came and laid His life down so that people could become citizens of His kingdom. But in order to be a citizen of the coming kingdom, you must repent of your sins and trust in the finished work of Jesus Christ. That's in this chapter. We're just not there yet. Stand with me if you will.